In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stevens Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
You got the Mighty Manfred here in Little Stevens Underground Garage, and it's time for your coolest conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening, and please remember, follow, subscribe, rate, and review. I'll be speaking today with Peter Buck, best known for his guitar playing in REM, but he's also a member of the No Ones. We'll feature Buck's longtime collaborator, Scott McCoy. The group's latest album is My Best Evil Friend. It's available from Yep Rock Records, and it features our recent coolest song in the world, KLIV. Let's give a listen to some of that now, and afterwards I'll chat with Peter Buck on your Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock in Little Stevens Underground Garage.
One last kiss. Peppermint twist. Oh, the monster mash and dead man's curve and Shangri-La's cry and crash. 45s with capital swirl. Swan and Tully and VJ. Don't drop out. No way.
Mighty Manfred, and dear listener, it's time for our coolest conversations, and my special guest is musician, songwriter, and producer Peter Buck. First came to prominence as a guitarist in REM, and has since been involved in quite a number of groups and projects, including the Minus Five, the Baseball Project, and the No Ones, and it's the latter, the No Ones, who provide us with this week's coolest song in the world, KLIV. Peter, how are you?
I'm great, Manfred. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Good to be speaking with you again. Something I just realized the other day, maybe this was 3 or 4 months ago, but I never realized that John Hammond Jr. was not actually a junior. He's actually John Paul Hammond, and his father was John Henry Hammond. And the only reason that comes to mind is I read somewhere that your dad is a Peter as well. Is that right?
Yeah, Peter Buck. He had different middle names. And thank God I'm not a junior.
Would being a junior have changed any expectations that your family would have had on you?
I think their expectations weren't reasonable anyway. So I don't know. But thankfully, my dad's middle names were Wilfred Lewis, and you couldn't do that to a young child. So I'm quite happy.
So he had two middle names?
Yeah, I don't know why.
Man, that's pretty heavy. That is very heavy. My brother has got two middle names. He's a Maurice Richard Walter Jones, and that's pretty heavy. So you were born in Berkeley, California?
Yeah, and then lived in Indiana, Los Angeles, moved to Georgia in 1970.
So how old were you when moved to Georgia?
13.
Okay, 13. So when you got to Georgia, like I grew up in DeKalb County, and there was no middle school there. It was just elementary school 1 through 7, and then 8 through 12 was high school. Did they have a middle school? Were you when you got to Georgia, or were you automatically in high school?
I was in high school. I was in seventh grade or eighth grade. I can't remember which. And I definitely right in high school, Roswell High School.
Well, I was, you and I share a former employer, Wexstreet Records. And when you would come in, you always would buy like really cool stuff. And with REM, you guys always did cool covers. When you were growing up, was there lots of music in the household?
My parents' household? No.
Yeah.
My old man, he thought that if classical music, like a piece of classical music ended with a cannon going off, that was big time good stuff. But I brought lots of music in. I mean, starting with the radio when I was, you know, six. And then I started buying records immediately after seeing the Beatles and Ed Sullivan. So it was pretty much a lifelong consumption thing.
Well, how old were you when you saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan?
I think I was six.
Okay.
I was old and you know, I had heard them on the radio and was really excited. And like everyone else on earth, my generation, it kind of changed my life.
Well, that is something I hear all the time, and it's going to be interesting. You know, we're already in a point where that's not that cultural tipping point, but it is cool to come across people. I wouldn't have thought that you had seen the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. So you were hearing music on the radio, but there weren't, you're like, it's not like your parents were playing instruments or,
nope.
No. Do you have any siblings?
Yeah, I have a brother. He's a good guitar player. He studied classical music for a long time, but I don't know why it hit so hard for me. I mean, partly it was just a way out of the grimness of life, you know. I mean, as a six-year-old, the Beatles represented freedom. I went to see Hard Day's Night, you know, when it came out that spring, and it was just like, oh yeah, that's how I want my life to be.
So that was the epiphany.
Definitely the Beatles. It was the first time I realized that music had a place in my world other than just stuff that was, you know, leaking out of the radio in the car. And I immediately began, you know, buying records and obsessing about who was my favorite band and watching all the 60s shows, you know, Shindig and Hullabaloo. And, you know, I would go in shops and, you know, I'd be like nine and I'd have the clerks help me. Like, I go, well, what do you think? Should I get this Tom Jones or the Beach Boys? Oh, get the Beach Boys. It's better than Tom Jones. Okay, cool.
I don't know. What about now? I mean, if you're going in, you're still going to know, you're going to forego Tom Jones still, or are there some Tom Jones records hidden away in your collection now?
Oh, I like Tom Jones. Yeah. It was just, you know, as a 10-year-old or eight or whatever I was trying to be cool.
Right.
Yeah, that country record he made with Green Green Grass of Home and a couple other things. That's a really good record. I mean,
right.
You know, Scott and I went to see him play in Las Vegas in like 95, and it was when he was doing his industrial thing. So he'd play What's New Pussycat, and then he'd go, and now I'd like to do a song by the Wolfgang Press. And you go, okay, cool.
Well, what got you playing guitar?
You know, wanting to be in the Beatles. And, you know, looking at the Beatles and knowing that John and Paul wrote the songs, I thought, well, I could be George. He doesn't sing that much and he doesn't seem to write songs, so I'll just stand at the back and play guitar. And little did I know how good he was as a guitar player and that he ended up being a really good songwriter and a great singer.
So were you playing in any, when did you start playing guitar? How old were you when you picked up a guitar?
You know, when I finally got my hands on one, I think I was 14. And, you know, I couldn't find anybody in Georgia that even partway agreed with me on what good music was. You know, it was the Allman Brothers in those days, and they're great, but I didn't really want to be in an Allman Brothers cover band. So I kind of wrote songs in my bedroom and, you know, played with people, and nothing really came of it until really REM.
So you started off, you went to Roswell High School, you mentioned, and then you started off collegiate days like in Emory. Is that right? You went to Emory?
Yeah, dropped out within like a year, and then hitchhiked around the country. I brought a guitar with me and I ended up in California and I was trying to put together a band out there. I thought, well, you go to California. And unfortunately, I went to San Luis Obispo where there isn't a whole lot of showbiz, but
it's, you know, pretty up there. My daughter goes to college there. In fact, I wasn't even aware of the place until Cal Poly, until
until she said she wanted to go to school there. So it's very picturesque.
It's a cool town, but in 1976 or whenever I was out there, it was everybody like the Grateful Dead. And you just couldn't find anyone who didn't want to sound like the Grateful Dead. And, you know, it just wasn't what I was doing.
So from Allman Brothers to Grateful Dead, you're still in search.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't until you got back to Georgia after hitchhiking around in like 77 that, you know, punk rock had started affecting the way, you know, the local bands. And there were some great local bands, the Fans, the Brains that had Tom Gray, who wrote Money Changes Everything. And of course, the B-52s, which are, they were just amazing to see first time.
So you hitchhike around the country. What? Why go back to school, and why go back to why go to UGA in Athens?
You know, I was working at a record store in Atlanta, and I quit or got fired. Somewhere between the two. And I was friends with the guys that had the Wux Street in Atlanta, and asked if they had any openings. I said, not here, but we have an opening like Monday in Athens. And I'd never really been up there, and I just went, okay, I'll drive up to Athens, find a place to live, and work at this record store.
And how old were you at the time?
Roughly. Like 2021, maybe. Like almost immediately met Michael and started working on what became REM.
So working at a record store, that was that like a dream job at the time?
It was my dream job since I was a kid. I've always had... You know, like when I was 13, I worked at this record store north of Glendale, can't remember its name. And I just kind of said, listen, I'll come in and I'll clean up and I'll cut up the boxes and take out the trash as long as I get discounts on records. You don't have to pay me. And they thought that was a great deal. And I thought it was a great deal. And I ended up, you know, getting, and then occasionally I'd get a promo copy. And also I could tell all my friends, yeah, I work there, you know, and we'd go in and kind of hang out with these guys who were kind of Cheech and Chong-y type, you know. You know, it was 1970 or whatever. And I did that in place in Atlanta too. And then finally got a real job working at record stores, which, you know, if things hadn't worked out for me, I'm sure I'd be managing a record store right now.
So you mentioned meeting Michael Stipe, and then you guys run into Bill Berry and Mike Mills, and you have this great success with REM. And then when that ends around, like, what, 2011, right as that comes to an end, was there a moment of like, well, how the hell did all that happen?
I still think that, you know, it's, yeah. I have, you know, the fantasies that you have growing up, it pretty much came true. You know, it's like you form a band with three other guys and there's this great chemistry and all of a sudden you're really successful. And it went on for years and years and years. I'm really spoiled. You know, I didn't do the five sets a night of covers. And I, you know, we did our first show in Athens and got 500 people. So, you know, when it was over, I guess my options were to try to keep working at that level. I don't even know how to do that, or walk away from it and play music in a different situation.
Let's talk about some of these different situations. In fact, we should start with talking about Scott McCoy. And I know him first from the Young Fresh Fellows, the Seattle band, and he later became a sideman with REM. And he's been your musical partner, collaborator on a whole bunch of projects, the Minus Five, the baseball project, a bunch of stuff. And specifically today, we're just talking especially about the No Ones. How did you guys meet?
Scott and I think Jim Sangster, maybe, from Young Fresh Fellows, came to see us in 84, the first time we played Seattle. And he gave me their first record, the first Young Fresh Fellows record, Exciting Sounds of the Pacific Northwest. And, you know, I didn't have a turntable. So I got back to Georgia 6 months later with a pile of records, a foot deep, just going through them. And I got the Young Fresh Fellows record and went, wow, this thing's great. It's a really great record. So next time I was in town, I looked him up. And from then on, whenever we crossed paths, we'd hang out and we had the same musical tastes. They're pretty wide. It started playing music, you know, kind of together in the early 90s.
Well, what's so special about this guy that keeps you two in each other's orbits? Because, I mean, you've been working together for so long with so many different projects. Is it just the music connection? I mean, is this the brother from another mother? What is it about this dude?
Yeah, well, we're somehow related in some weird way. But it is kind of like a weird marriage. I mean, I could be kind of down and moody and whatever. And Scott is not. He's always like, okay, we can do this. We can make some music. And, you know, I always found it inspiring when I was playing in REM that, you know, Scott really wasn't worried about how big the crowd was or if he's. And once REM ended, and I'd been playing outside of the band for years, but it just felt like, yeah, you know what? There's a whole world you can fill up with music that doesn't really involve, you know, videos or interviews or anything other than recording and writing and playing.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time for an interview today, though, I have to say, you know. So the latest album from the No Ones is titled My Best Evil Friend. Your first one, though, is the great Lost No Ones album that came out like in 2020. When is it that you guys settled on the No Ones? So when did the No Ones form?
We were doing these shows in Norway that were climate change kind of awareness concerts that were put together by a friend of ours in Vadsø, Norway, which is far north of the Arctic Circle, you know, reindeer walking down the streets, that kind of thing. And we met those guys who were in I Was a King, which is a really great band. And somebody suggested, well, you guys should, why don't you like record two songs for this upcoming festival? And we recorded five, and then we just kept writing. And we did that first record just kind of setting tracks back and forth. And we had like 5 days to record in Portland. And the plan was, well, we're going to tour in 2020. We'll get to Norway. We'll make a record over there. And then, you know, everyone seems to remember what happened in March of 2020. So we ended up making this record completely by mail, which is totally backwards, but it doesn't really sound like it.
And when we're talking about the Norwegian band, I Was a King, these guys are Arne the drummer and Frode the, he's also a guitar player, right?
He's a player, singer, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so that's how the first album came together. When and where did you record the latest one, My Best Evil Friend?
Well, that we did it in the middle of the whole, you know, no one can travel situation. So
okay, still, yeah.
We recorded our parts in Scott's basement. And if it was the song we came up with, it would be drum machine, bass, three guitars, keyboards, send it off. They'd put drums and guitar on and vocals. If it came from them, it was guitar and drums and vocals, and we'd add to it over here. So I haven't seen them in 4 years, 5 years. But that, you know, it was a way you could do it. So I think I made 3 or 4 records like that while we weren't really traveling. Ideally, I like to be in the same room, but that just wasn't going to happen.
Well, you know, you have to make use of the, you know, sometimes technology kind of works against things, but here was certainly a benefit to be able to continue to make music and to record an album even, you know, I think it's pretty cool. So my understanding about the record is that it's about the music that made a difference in your lives, in Scott's life, in your life, in the other guys' lives. Is that the idea? Is that what the song?
I didn't know that was what was going on. But about the third or fourth song, I kind of, these seem to be all about music, you know. And you can listen to the record and not really notice that. But that's going, did you just write a song about Pamela Pollard? You know, and so, yeah, that was kind of, it was, I hate to call it a tribute to music, because I think Scott had a record called that, but it started coming out as, these are just little glimpses into the world that changed us.
Well, a cool song in the world this week is KLIV or KLIV off My Best Evil Friend. And according to Wikipedia, that was a radio station, San Jose, California, and they're the ones that broke the Count Five Psychotic Reaction in 1966. And you guys name check the band in the song. In fact, in the video, you just happen to be holding the album cover, the Count Five album cover. So, I mean, you were born there in Berkeley, but was it Scott that was listening to KLIV, or was it yourself?
Oh, Scott. You know, I left San Francisco in 1965 or something. And I remember listening to the radio there. I don't remember what station. It was AM. But I moved around so much, I didn't, you know, like I I probably listened to KHJ and KRLA in Los Angeles between, I think, 69 and 68 and 70, more than any other AM station. I was just discovering FM when I moved to Georgia, and there was a couple of good college stations I listened to, and AM went out the window because it was 1970 and 71. And you remember what that was like, Hamilton, Joe Frank and Reynolds, and just all kinds of stuff that you just...
Right. So, but before you moved out, I mean, as you you mentioned, you know, seeing the Beatles and Ed Sullivan, and so that's sort of the glory day still of AM and you know, singles and rock pop on the radio there through the 60s. Is there something? And of course, this, you know, you're coming yourself or Scott, whichever, coming of age and hearing things on the radio. I just wonder, is there? Or do you feel like there's a relationship, a special relationship that sort of that of one has with listening to radio versus like nowadays? I mean, like my daughter, when she was in middle school, she did listen to the radio, but as she entered in her teens, the radio became secondary to, you know, finding out about music through streaming services or YouTube or these other avenues of listening to music. But I don't know that it just seems to me that there's a specific relationship one has by listening to radio versus, you know, some algorithm derived streaming service or what do you think?
Well, you know, any way you want to hear music is valid, but I remember feeling like, wow, a bunch of people are listening to this song right now. And I remember, you know, like the AM guys that did have the new Beatles record coming up, you know, it's or whatever, the new Rolling Stones. I lived in Los Angeles when it was before Exile on Main Street. It was Sticky Fingers came out. And I think Wolfman Jack had a radio station like way at the far end of the AM dial. And they played that record all the time. And it was always, you know, there'd be trumpets and something from the news. Rolling Stones record. And it was exciting to know that you were hearing it along with maybe hundreds of thousands of other people.
About the other, this particular track, KLIV, did the song come together quickly?
Or the lyrics? They all did. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're going on tour pretty soon and I'm going to have to learn them. You know, you know, you write them on Tuesday, record them on Wednesday, and then a year and a half later, you've got a record and you're kind of going, yeah, I don't even remember that song. but that's the way it works. You know, apparently I'm going to be the bass player in this band. So I've got to learn them all in bass.
Well, that's no challenge for you, multi-instrumentalist.
You know, not really. I mean, I like playing bass. I love the part of being a bass player. I probably should have been a bass player rather than a guitar player, but I'm always happy if someone gets up. If we don't have a bass player, I'll be glad to do it.
You know, another standout track on the album is Phil Oakes Is Dead. And I especially like the lyric, Phil Oakes is dead, but yes, I guess, but never too far gone. Who wrote the lyrics to Phil Oakes Is Dead?
Scott wrote almost all the lyrics on the record, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, okay, all right.
You know, I think that, I know that Scott and I are both huge Phil Oakes fans. And, you know, it's sad what happened to him and where he ended up. But I think if he were anywhere around, he'd be pleased to know that the people still listen to his records, you know. I mean, Pleasures of the Harbor is one of my favorite records of all time.
Have you ever had an occasion to meet his brother, Michael Oakes?
Not formally. I think we've been in the same room.
Yeah. So another tune, One Night at the Fillmore, is that a specific night that Scott went to the venue?
Well, I don't know if there's a specific night, but, you know, I was always kind of envious because I was living in Georgia, you know, by 1970, which is when I started to be old enough to go to shows. And believe me, we didn't have anything like the Fillmore there. I mean, shows came through. I saw a lot of stuff, but, you know, Scott's just a couple years older than me and he saw all this amazing stuff because it was, you know, San Jose, San Francisco.
Right.
So he'd always share the stories of seeing, you know, these people I consider really legendary. You know, I saw, you know, this guy five times. It's like, you know, Nobody ever came to Georgia in the early 70s, except for kind of boogie bands.
Yeah, right. What was it like, the Agora Ballroom? Was that a place?
Yeah, it was the Agora. I think it was the Electric Ballroom first. That's where I saw, you know, I saw Wizard there. One of like the 20 people in America who saw Wizard live. And then there was a place called Rose's Cantina right downtown that it's like everyone who worked there looked like they were a roadie for the New Riders of Purple Sage, you know, cowboy boots, mustaches. But it's where they first started doing, you know, kind of left field music there. So the local bands, the Fans and the Brains played there. And there'd be this big conflict, like these mustachioed cowboy headed hippie types, you know, just really pissed off at us, whatever we were, the short haired, weird new people. So, you know, I managed to see a whole lot of great stuff. But it's not like having the Fillmore right in your backyard.
Well, so you mentioned Scott writing the lyrics. Do any of these songs relate specifically to any musical event in your life?
Only because they're the same musical events. I don't know if you've seen
video
for that for KLIV, but, you know, we're just going through our record collections and showing things, you know. Scott particularly came over to my house. He says, yeah, I've got to shoot something for this video. And he says, I can't find my Count Five record. Oh, I've got it. And I think mine has a 47-cent sticker on it, you know. And he said, well, do you have any original James Browns? Like, yeah, I got those too. And, you know, I pulled out 20 of the, you know, early 60s James Brown albums. So, you know, for Scott and I, they're very similar, how we approach what we listen to. And, you know, we both read a lot about music too. I mean, sometimes you just have to read Cream magazine because you were never going to see half the stuff that they were talking about.
Right. Well, you mentioned having to relearn the songs, right? Writing on a Tuesday, recorded on a Wednesday, and now playing. Well, I saw that upcoming you have shows June the 16th, one in Portland, the 17th in Seattle. Then the end of June, beginning of July, you're going overseas to do shows in Europe. Are there any other plans for U.S. dates later in the year?
I don't know. We're really busy. Scott and I each have like three or four records coming out. I've been doing a lot of work in Brazil, and I think I'm going to be working down there for about 6 months.
Well, what are you doing in Brazil?
I'm playing with this guy, Nando Reis. Well, it's pronounced Hayes, but it's R-E-I-S. And he's kind of the biggest rock star in Brazil, and I've been playing on his records for years. And we've just finished a three-record set that's kind of mind-blowingly great. So he asked me if I'd tag along to play rhythm guitar, and I just felt like, yeah, you know, this is interesting. I'm taking Portuguese lessons, you know, on my phone. You know, if you want to know if the dog has a ball, I can tell you that in Portuguese.
Does the dog have the ball?
O que choro tem um bola.
Well, I'll take your word for it. Take your word for it. You know, we're going to have to wrap up things in a moment, and we're going to take a listen to The After Party. It closes out the album. Listen to it. Well, two things that I want to ask you about. One is the song makes me think of this notion that, you know, if there's a rock and roll heaven, you know, there's going to be one hell of a party. I think that's the expression. And I can kind of see that in the song, thinking of sort of later in one's years and thinking of, you know, what comes next. And then the other thing is actually being in a band and performing, and you know, it's okay, but it's kind of a laundry list night, but you know, it's all right. But then you think, oh, afterwards I'm really gonna have a good time later on, you know. Where are you in that spectrum with that song?
Well, I think that my after party 25 years ago is a lot different than mine is now. You know, when COVID came along, I realized 100% of my socializing, aside from my children, is music related. So for me, rehearsals, being in the van, sound check, doing the shows, hanging out with the people in the band afterwards and talking, that's really fun. You know, I don't really want to carry my luggage from room to room, and no one likes the load in, but, you know, it's all part of the picture. And we have really good times in the van, you know, driving from one place to another. I mean, and if I didn't do this stuff, I don't know what I'd do. Sit around the house.
Well, there you mentioned this earlier. You know, when the REM ends, and then it's like, you know, what goes on forward. I mean, this, you hit the jackpot early on, and you've been able to take advantage of that. You know, so this you have the unique you've had the unique opportunity of making this your complete adult life, really.
Absolutely. And, you know, I know it's not reaching a huge amount of people what I do, but I'm making music that I think is really, really pretty great with people that I really like hanging around with, that I respect, and I get to do it. You know, if you'd shown myself a picture of me right now and didn't mention that I was in REM, but, oh, I'm playing to 60 people a night on Tuesday with these guys, I'd think, man, you did pretty good with your life. And that's the way I feel.
Hey, brother, I'm going to tell you, playing to 60 people on a Tuesday, that's not so bad. That's a Tuesday night.
No, you know, I mean, I don't go out on Tuesdays anymore unless it's really important. So, I feel just incredibly lucky to have done all this and be able to continue to do it.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for talking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Thank you, man. It was nice talking to you again.
Now, we're going to hear all about the after party. It's the No Ones off their album, My Best Evil Friend, in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
The show was spotted, less than triumphant. My flow was clotted, encore redundant, but now it's over. Just starting, I'm getting closer to the after party. I'm getting closer to the after.
That was the No Ones here in Little Steven's Underground Garage with a portion of their tune, The After Party. It's from their latest album, My Best Evil Friend, and it's available from Yep Rock Records. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Peter Buck for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. A longtime fixture in the punk band The Dwarves was a rhythm guitarist, he who cannot be named. And he's had several solo albums. The latest is called Imposter, and we'll find out all about it on our next Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
That's me in the corner.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.